publications The Guardian and The Economist. She has reported from many Islamic countries over the last 10 years, from the Middle East to North Africa and Central Asia. As a correspondent based in Cairo, she covered the Middle East for the Dallas Morning News. She reported the fall of the Soviet Union for Reuters news agency. She also has worked as a staff writer for Newsday and the Baltimore Evening Sun. She is the author of a book that we'll be talking about here this morning. It's titled No God But God, Egypt and the Triumph of Islam, and it is published by the Oxford University Press, in which she looks at the Islamist movement, actually really, in a sense, two movements that have been active in Egypt in recent years. One that received a great deal of attention in the media because of violence. And the other, which he argues, is maybe has not gotten as much attention, but as the first one has declined in influence, the second one has grown. And she makes the argument that, in fact, there is an Islamist movement in Egypt that rejects the idea of violent overthrow of the government and has perhaps a more accommodationist kind of approach when it comes to living in and with the modern world. So if you're interested in the subject, certainly the book is available in the bookstores. You can go and look for it. And your questions and comments are welcome here on the program. If you'd like to join in the conversation, all you have to do is call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL. And toll-free, 800-222-WILO. Ms. Abdo, hello.
Hello, hi.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Sure.
I came across a commentary you wrote for the Christian Science Monitor recently, and I think that perhaps offers us a place to start and establish a large context before perhaps we focus on Egypt specifically. And essentially, I won't read all of this, but essentially you make the argument that when the fighting in Afghanistan is over, if indeed the United States achieves its stated aim, there still will be a very large challenge facing the United States when we think about our relationship with people in the region, in West Asia, in South Asia, in the Middle East, and that is a broad-based Islamization of societies. And you say argue in this piece, that one of the places that this is in full bloom is Egypt. So we can talk about that. But maybe to have the start with the frame of reference a little bit larger, in what way does this pose a challenge, do you think, to the United States?
It poses a challenge because certainly since September 11th, there's been a lot of discussion about winning the hearts and minds of Muslims and Arabs, and it's become quite a cliche. And that is essentially what the next challenge is, because although public opinion in the Islamic world in no way condones the violence that happened on September 11th, we have to remember that some of the grievances that Osama bin Laden has articulated have widespread support. People in the Islamic world agree with these grievances. And so even if Osama bin Laden is killed, even if the Al-Qaeda network dissolves and we are completely successful in our military campaign in Afghanistan, what will remain is a far more profound challenge, and that is to win over public opinion in the Islamic world, to show people, Muslims, that we are not, that we're going to change our policies, and that the interference into their domestic affairs and all the kinds of grievances that they have will somehow be addressed.
Specifically in Egypt, I think that you begin rightly and by noting that here in the West, those Islamists that have used violence, those are the ones that have gotten the attention in the media. And for that reason, I'm sure in a lot of people's minds, and they might say with justification, that they associate these groups with violence, with a very strong anti-Western and anti-American orientation, and that what you're suggesting is is in Egypt, certainly that was true. I mean, those groups did exist, but that in a sense there were two wings here, one that advocated violence and one that did not. And your argument is that over time, in fact, there has been less and less support for those that would advocate violence and a growing support for those who are interested in changing their society, in establishing an Islamic society, but doing it in a peaceful manner.
Yes, and in fact, the reason that this is particularly relevant now is that we are seeing that many Egyptians who were part of the militant movement in Egypt became part of Osama bin Laden's network. Some of them now, at least the U.S. government has reported, have been killed in some of the bombing raids. But what happened in the 1970s in Egypt is that the Islamic movement, which was fairly sort of amorphous at that point, it split. Those who advocated violence became part of groups that are very familiar to us now, such as Islamic Jihad. Those who believed that they could that they wanted to try to gain political power peacefully became very involved in university organizations, and then later when they graduated from the universities and they left their Islamic groups there, they became involved in syndicates, or what are called syndicates, which we know as sort of trade unions. And there they became very powerful. These were trade unions that had hundreds of thousands of members. They also became very involved in all sorts of aspects of creating welfare organizations that would address issues such as medical care for Egyptians. And these were middle-class people. This is the movement that became very powerful within the society. And as you just pointed out, these people do not want to overthrow President Mubarak. They simply want to be involved in the political process.
Something in a more general term that I'm interested in you responding to. Earlier this week, we had another conversation, a conversation with an academic here at the university about Islamist movements. And as is often the case, I received an email from someone afterwards with comments on the program. And this particular listener was unhappy with what the guest had to say, because the listener felt that the guest was underplaying the tendency of Islamist groups to engage particularly in violence against outsiders, against people of other faiths, Christians particularly, and the listener would say, if you point to places like Iran, like Afghanistan, Sudan particularly, where the caller felt there had been a good deal of persecution of Christians there, that the record of these movements is not very good. It's certainly not peaceful, and that one can hardly not emphasize enough the tendency of these groups to use violence and to use violence particularly against non-Muslims. And I guess I came away from this conversation at the very least with the idea that, well, what we want to say is you don't want to paint with the broad brush and say that all Islamist movements are alike. And I guess one has to acknowledge what in some sense the listener said was true. These things have happened in Afghanistan, in Iran, and in Sudan. And yet at the same time, how do we try to understand this phenomenon in a larger sense and say that it is not a monolithic kind of a thing, and that you really have to look on a case-by-case basis at what it is these groups are trying to do and the means they choose to employ?
Yes, it is. It's a very complicated question, but also one that's very important. And the first way to try to tackle this is to first of all understand that those people who are not tolerant of non-Muslims, whether they be Christians or ethnic minorities or whatever, these are generally militant groups. If you take note of any of Osama bin Laden's statements about the infidel, about the non-Muslims, of course he's on the fringe of the whole Islamic world. as are many groups who make such racist comments about Christians and ethnic groups. But I think that if you look at what goes on in mainstream societies, you see a different picture. I mean, if you want to take Iran as an example, certainly Iran is far from any sort of democratic political system. However, the Iranian government, and particularly under President Khatami, since he was elected in 1997, the Iranian government has gone a long way to try to address the concerns and the cultural needs of its minority Sunni population. Now, of course, Iran is a Shiite country, so the Sunni Muslims in those countries are the minority, and many of them live in what is called Kurdistan. Now, what President Khatami did, he appointed a Kurdish governor to rule this part of Iran, Kurdistan, and the governor has taken all sorts of measures, such as returning Kurdish language to some of the schools, to creating a whole sort of cultural revival of Kurdish in that part of Iran. Another example that I would use is the Islamic moderates in Egypt, the ones that are the subject of my book. What they did in the 1990s, actually, is they tried to form a political party with Copts in Egypt. Now, the Copts are Christians, and particularly in the 1990s, there were a lot of gun battles. There was a lot of violence initiated by the militants against Christians in the southern part of Egypt. So the moderates wanted to try to accommodate the Christians and to show that they don't share these kinds of racist attitudes. They tried to create a political party with the Christians in Egypt, but the party was banned by the government. So I think that we have to distinguish between what the opinions are of these militant movements and what the opinions are of mainstream Muslims, many of whom are trying to reach some sort of accommodation with minorities, whether they be defined by linguistic differences or cultural differences or religious differences.
Let me, at this point, introduce again our guests for folks who are listening. We're talking with Genevieve Abdo. She's a journalist. At the moment, she's a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. And most recently, she's worked as correspondent in Iran for The Guardian and The Economist. Those are two British publications. She has also reported from a number of Islamic countries over the last 10 years. She worked for the Dallas Morning News as a Cairo-based correspondent. She also has worked for Reuters, for Newsday, and the Baltimore Evening Sun. And her book, which is about Egypt, is titled No God But God, Egypt and the Triumph of Islam, published by the Oxford University Press, in which she takes a look at what she calls, what she says, a more moderate kind of Islamist movement that has come about in Egypt, rejects violence as a way of getting what they want, but certainly is interested in establishing a kind of Islamic society in Egypt. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I guess just another in the way of a general question, and you can talk about the people that you profile in the book and what it is they're interested in achieving. I think that one, in talking about these groups and how it is that in some cases people have taken up arms, they have said that, pointed to the way that governments in their countries have responded to their presence and said that we would certainly like to work through the democratic process, but our governments aren't interested in having a challenge, and that's just not a possibility for us. That avenue is not open. However, I think people here in the West have some concerns or perhaps suspicions about when groups, you know, Islamist groups talk about their interest in democracy and the democratic process, is that they don't mean democracy the way we mean democracy, in the sense that I think there is some doubt whether once these groups, if they achieve their goal and established an Islamic society, whether there indeed would be free and open elections with a multi-party system, whether there would be freedom of religion for people who are not Muslim, whether there would be the kind of things that we at least think are important, things like freedom of expression and freedom of speech. And there seems to be, I think, some concern about, well, what really do they mean when they talk about democracy, and what sort of society do they have in mind?
Yes, certainly that is a legitimate concern. And if we look at some of the examples that we have seen over the last 10 or 20 years, perhaps there isn't so much hope or that's why people can become might become cynical. If you look at Algeria, for example, what militant Islamists have done there. But I think that what most Islamic moderates want are many of the things that we value, and as you mentioned, they do want to have free expression in their country. And we must keep in mind that some of the countries that we're talking about, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, there is virtually no free press. So unless you are supporting and writing the views that reflect those of the government, you basically don't have a voice. And that's true also in elections. For the most part, in Egypt, when parliamentary elections are held, those in the majority, the people who are allowed to run to begin with, forget about even those who are voted in office, but those who are allowed to run from the start, they basically have to reflect the views of the government. And this is what the Islamists are against. They want a more pluralistic system. Now, what guarantees do we have that they're going to formulate some sort of democracy? The first thing is that the kind of democracy that they advocate, by the nature of the fact that they are trying to create some sort of Islamic society, is not going to be a Western-style democracy. And they say this very openly, and we, although it's a bit difficult for us as Americans to understand this, we have to be sure to distinguish the kind of a political system that these kind of groups even want to form, because they are going to create a system that would take as its sort of basis the Quran and the Hadiths, the sayings of the Prophet. So obviously in America, I mean, we don't have a political system that's based on any sort of religious text, because there's a separation between church and state. In Islam, this separation doesn't exist. If you want to look at the political system in Iran, for example, they say that they are trying to move toward a democracy, but clerics sit on many of the governmental institutions that oversee the legislation passed by the parliament, which is elected. And if they don't like this legislation, if they don't believe that it conforms to the Islamic texts, then they just veto it. They overrule it. So in these kinds of countries, they would create a democracy that is in accordance with their Islamic beliefs. And by that, I mean that they could only create a political system that somehow conforms to readings of the Islamic text on all these issues that we're talking about: freedom of expression, free elections, more rights for women. They advocate these things as long as they are compatible with their own interpretations of what the Quran and some of the Islamic texts say.
So it seems though there is real potential for conflict across this line between the Muslim world and the Western, largely Judeo-Christian one.
Well, it doesn't have to be a conflict, and I guess the reason that I wrote a book in which I tried without judgment to explain the ideas of moderate Islamists and to explain why they have these ideas is that it doesn't have to be a confrontational relationship. I think that in addition to understanding this whole religion that is somewhat foreign to us, since September 11th, we also need to realize that Muslims should have a right to self-determination in their own countries, and that the United States needs to get out of micromanaging politics and a lot of the countries that are the core of this conflict. And that is really the source of the problem. Sure, in the end, if Islamists come to power, they might not have the kind of governments that we would approve wholeheartedly. But in fact, I mean, the reality of the modern world and the reality of the rise of Islamic nationalism, if you want to call it that, religious nationalism in general, is that we as Americans have to come to terms with the fact that we cannot dictate to the world what their policy should be. And this is really what the Muslims are telling us, that the average Muslim on the street in all these countries, they want a right to self-determination, and that's something that we're going to have to deal with in the end. And I think that this is in the article I wrote about in the Christian Science Monitor, this is my point, that this broader challenge for the hearts and minds of Muslims can only be one if we are willing to accept them on in according to their value system and on their terms, not according to ours.
All right. We have a caller to talk to, bring into the conversation on our line one. Let's do that. Hello.
Yes. I wanted to ask you if you're familiar with the work of Bat Yeor, and her explication of the, I think the term is diminitude, which seems to historically be a secondary status of the people of the book, that is, Christians and Jews. And I just would be interested to hear how you would respond to her work in light of the more moderate position that there are some Muslims who hold. I'll just let you talk about that. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with her work. I mean, I'm familiar with the general concept, but I'm not really familiar with her work. I mean, do you have a specific question? Perhaps I could try.
Well, if you're not familiar with it, one of her titles, I think, for example, is The Decline of the Eastern Church Under the Muslims. That's a rough title, very rough. And she's explored a lot of the issues that have to do with the fact that in virtually every Muslim country, everyone else would have a secondary status to those who are Muslims. And I don't know.
That was the case historically centuries ago.
Well,
non-Muslims.
On the other hand, I'm not aware that is there a Muslim country in which Christians and Jews, for that matter, have, quote, equal status to the majority?
Yes. I mean, there are Jewish minorities in many Arab countries. In Syria, there's a Jewish minority. In Egypt, there's a Jewish minority. Even in Iran, there is a Jewish minority. And I don't know if you remember reading the stories last year about the Jews in Iran who went on trial for espionage. But the Jews in Iran,
would they be able to express themselves, and would they be able to...
Yes, of course. In all of these countries, even in Syria, there are synagogues. Jews worship freely. In Iran, the same situation exists. Jews don't have any... in Iran have the same legal rights as any Muslim.
Okay, that's what I was really getting at. I mean, I know that they have the right to exist in most of those countries, although I still have the sense that it's fairly limited by comparison to, say, the right that, especially before September the 11th, that a Muslim would have had in this country or in England or any of the other Western-style democracies. I guess the last question I would ask you is, out of what you've just said, what realistic kind of government do you think will finally come out of Afghanistan that is incarnations of that government go through its various stages? What do you think at the end of the day what it will look like?
That's a really difficult question, and I would hate to make a prediction at this stage because, as we all know, it's a very fluid kind of situation. I think, though, that we have to be very skeptical about how much harmony there is going to be among all the tribes and factions now trying to form some sort of stable government in Afghanistan, simply because history tells us that this is quite the likelihood of a stable government in Afghanistan is pretty grim. I mean, it doesn't seem, if you look at history, that this is a country that can accommodate all the differences in its population. And I think that a lot of it is going to depend upon the kinds of conditions and restraints and involvement that the United States and the coalition demand from the Afghan people and from their government. And so I think it's really difficult to predict, but I mean, as it's been reported, certainly in the last few weeks in particular, the political alliances are very tenuous. One day, you know, just as people were part of the Taliban, they shift sides. Just as people are part of the Northern Alliance or one tribe or one faction, they may shift sides. And in fact, there have been editorial cartoons about this, that, you know, one day I was with the Taliban and the next day I'm with the Northern Alliance. And I think that is a situation that is very particular to Afghanistan. So it's going to be a long and difficult road ahead, and I think that at this point it's very difficult to know if what happens now is going to stick in the future.
Let's go on to another caller. This is line number two. Hello?
Yes. The speaker before had mentioned about Jewish communities in Egypt and Syria, and that they have rights and so forth. If it's just stated that way, I think it's a little misleading, because, for example, in Egypt, where I've been, many Jews were forced to leave, and what's left in Egypt is the sorrowful remnants of a Jewish community with older people. I mean, where almost all of the population was forced to leave, and many sought refuge in Israel. I wonder if the speaker would want to correct her previous impression, and I'll hang up and listen.
I'm sorry, I would have to disagree with you, because Jews in Egypt were not forced to leave Egypt. They left voluntarily. That is true in most Arab countries, generally speaking. And some very few Jews remained, but some indeed did remain. So I don't really know of an example where Jews were forced to leave an Arab country. Even in Spain in 1492, there is a great historical debate among scholars as to what extent Jews left voluntarily and to what extent they were forced to leave.
Right. Okay, there's two issues here that I want to address that. But the first issue was the status. When you said that there is a Jewish community in Egypt and they have equal rights, it implied that this was, a normal community. This is a remnant of very old people, and it is. Do you disagree with that? Because I've seen that. I want to know what your opinion is.
Well, I mean, they're old people because they were at some point in time they decided to remain in Egypt, but this hasn't necessarily been true of younger generations. And the Jewish populations in some Arab countries are old, you're right, because they have remained there, whereas their children left. And
right.
So, that's why the Jewish populations tend to be older.
Yeah, but this implies that there's a sort of a thriving or at least an existing Jewish community. I mean, it's a pitiful remnant. And the question is, Jews could have stayed in Spain. I guess if someone was going to put thumbscrews and have an Inquisition, and if I was living then, I might be inclined to leave too. I mean, do you consider that voluntarily leaving? I mean, if you're subjected to, really harsh conditions and discrimination?
Well, I don't think that certainly in the Jewish population that we're talking about now, they're not subjected to harsh conditions.
I
don't really think that there's any evidence of that. So I think that you and I are sort of going in circles. But I mean,
well, why did they leave? Why did they all leave?
Well, because they don't want to be a minority in an Arab country.
Well, they had
because the state of Israel was created
in
1948, and so I mean, the whole idea of the state of Israel, the creation of the state of Israel, was to bring Jews who were in the diaspora into a promised land, into a country that had its own identity and that was an entity in and of itself. And I mean, that was the whole point of creating Israel. So why would Jews want to live in an Arab country when they could go to a state that had been established in Palestine? So I'm not really sure what your question is.
Well, I think my question is that I think you're presenting there's no point in continuing, but I think you're presenting a kind of distorted view, and I think that there are many Jews in Egypt who would have considered themselves Egyptians and who would have lived there in Egypt, but I think that the very harsh conditions is what led them to leave, and I think that the great migration, maybe 500,000 of Jews who left Arab countries, did so not, quote, voluntarily to go to a promised land, but because the conditions at home made it impossible for them to stay there. I mean, that's my view, but what do you say, we're going in circles, so I don't think there's any point to continuing it.
Well, I do have other callers, and if you don't mind, we'll go on. And
yeah,
also,
please do get off.
We will remind people who are listening of our guest. We're speaking with Genevieve Abdo. She is a journalist at the moment. She's a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. She's been a correspondent in Iran for The Guardian and The Economist, two British publications. She's also reported from many other Islamic countries over the last 10 years, from the Middle East, North Africa, Central Asia. She was Cairo correspondent for the Dallas Morning News. She reported the fall of the Soviet Union for Reuters. She also was a staff writer for Newsday and the Baltimore Evening Sun. And she's the author of this book that we've mentioned that's about the Islamists of Egypt. It's titled No God But God, Egypt and the Triumph of Islam. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We have a number of others. I think next is line 3. Hello.
Hi. I am very happy the last caller called because I totally agree with him, and I believe it's a disservice to say that the minorities in the Middle East have the same rights as the majority. Case in point is in Iran. The Jews do not have the same rights as the others, and they live as second-class citizens. There is a reason why all the young people leave. It's not voluntarily. I mean, your guest is giving a totally new meaning to the word voluntarily, because it certainly is not that way. They can only have one representative in the parliament, and doesn't matter how many people, how many Jews are there, and they have to be very careful what to say and how they conduct themselves. So I believe this is one of the reasons that a lot of people here do not know what goes on in other parts of the world because of the wrong way that is presented here.
Well, Ms. Abdo, you want to respond to that?
I don't. I think that we have to sort of make a distinction between the general kind of difficulties that minorities face when they're in any country. I mean, look at blacks in America. Of course, there was a struggle for 200 years for racial equality. We have to separate what is perhaps the opinions of societies against minorities and what is actually legislated in governments. So in answering the last caller, what I was trying to explain is that in a legal sense, in terms of what is legislated, governments that I'm talking about in the Arab world, they don't create laws that discriminate against minorities, including Jews. Now, that doesn't mean that general populations don't look favorably upon ethnic minorities. They may or they may not. But, I mean, this isn't a problem that's particular to the Arab world. This is a problem that we face in the United States, which is why we have what's called affirmative action. So I think that we have to distinguish between what is legislated and what we're trying to contend with in terms of public opinion.
Actually, it is legislated in Iran that Jews can only have, not just Jews, but also Christian minorities, can only have one representative, excuse me, in the government. So, again, I think you're wrong here.
Well, that's in proportion to their population.
No, it's not proportionate. They only have one, and this is just like a figure person, so that they say, well, no, we do have people who represent. And also the other thing is, often when you talk to people in these countries, they tell you things that they believe you want to hear, while they may totally feel differently. And there's a danger there, too. But anyhow, I'll hang up.
The last comment I would like to respond to, which is that I spent years in some of the countries that we're talking about in the Arab world and in Iran, and I can assure you that I was not satisfied with people telling me just what I wanted to hear. And in fact, this is why I wrote books and tried to do more meaningful reporting. So I don't think that I'm not swayed by people telling me what I want to hear. What I'm telling, the comments that I'm making are basically based on my own conclusions, having spent several years living in the Arab world.
Let's go on. We have other callers. Next is line 1. Hello?
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if your guest has known any members of the Baha'i faith in the Arab countries?
No, I have not known any members of the Baha'i faith.
Uh-huh. Well, my understanding is that members of the Baha'i faith are still being prosecuted by Arabs and Muslims because of their interpretation of the Quran is that our founder, Baha'u'llah, came after Muhammad, and they believe in the seal of the prophet, so there is no other prophet but Muhammad. So do you know about what their position is in Egypt and Iran now?
There aren't many Baha'is, if any, in Egypt. In Iran, there are some Baha'is, and they do feel that they are under pressure. And Baha'is outside also are very reluctant to go back to Iran because of historical problems.
Uh-huh.
You know, again, the Iranian government says that they are trying to make attempts to accommodate the Baha'i faith. I know that a lot of people, a lot of Baha'is in this country who are Iranian, are a bit afraid to go back to Iran.
Right, right. I know that in the past, in Iran, Baha'is, their marriages were not recognized. They were unable to work. They were unable to teach their children the Baha'i faith or to have any classes. In fact, some young women who were teachers of Baha'i Sunday school were killed for doing that, and I just wondered if things had gotten any better for them.
I can't comment on that because I didn't do any reporting within the Baha'i community, so I'm sorry, but I cannot comment on that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go on. Next caller will be on line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm really interested. I think that the perspectives that are being brought by the speaker are very good, need to be more heard in the American media, which is so focused on the sort of pathological interpretation of Islam and Arab, Muslim and Arab countries. But I do feel like I have to, even though the conversation has been somewhat sidetracked by a couple of the previous callers, I do feel like I have to comment on the whole issue of Arab Jews emigrating to Israel. Did quite a bit of research on this last year. This notion that Jews were expelled from Arab countries has become kind of a standard part of Zionist Israeli propaganda. Jews were not expelled from Arab countries. They left under the pressure of social changes in those countries and also under great pressure from Israel to emigrate to Israel, to the point which Israel fomented conflict within particularly Egypt and other countries to get Jews to emigrate, to make the situation there so uncomfortable for them that they basically had no choice. So I just hope that the two previous callers will do a little research and find out what the history of Arab and Middle Eastern and North African Jews is, and how this situation is being used as a part of Israeli propaganda to justify this notion of equal exchange between Palestinians who were truly ethnically cleansed from Israel, as opposed to Arab Jews who were not ethnically cleansed or even expelled or in any remote sense where they can one generalize and say that they were expelled from those countries, albeit the situation in each one was very different and very complicated, and there were feelings against Jews in various times and places. But that's a notion that has been propagated in order to justify Israel's in unwillingness to deal with the Palestinian problem.
Thank you very much for your comments. I couldn't agree with you more.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. We'll go on to the next person. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I don't know specifically much about persecution of Jews in Islamic countries, but I do know that we have stories of Jews that have not only been driven out of Islamic countries, but they have been driven out of those countries with only the clothes on their back. They have had to flee in terror. I know that in some of the Arab Emirates, I think it's Qatar, the Jews were all airlifted. They gathered at one, I guess they gathered at the airport and were airlifted out in one day. I'm not sure that it was Qatar. It was one of the Arab Emirates from which they were airlifted just in one day. In other words, they had to leave secretly, I suppose, so that their property would not be confiscated. I know a lot more about anti-Christian persecution in Arab in Muslim countries. And one of the Arab countries that persecutes Christians is Egypt. They persecute Coptic Christians. This persecution has not only been reported in the Christian press here in the United States, but it's been reported by the London Telegraph. The popular press simply doesn't report it, but the persecution has been terrible. In Pakistan, an Arab country, the press finally did, after the 9/11 attack on America, Muslims entered one of the Christian churches in Pakistan and machine-gunned the parishioners that killed them. And we remember that. You remember that story. In Indonesia, as we speak, Muslims are attacking Christian communities. They are burning churches. They are killing and raping Christians, and they are doing so with the connivance and cooperation of the Indonesian soldiers, in other words, of the Indonesian government. In Sudan, 2 million Christians have been killed by Muslims, and those not killed, many of them have been enslaved. They have active slave markets in many Muslim countries, including Saudi Arabia. Now, these things are true. I know they're true. When I reported some of the stuff that was going on in Indonesia while on Focus 580, the very program you're on, there was a government official that was talking about religious persecution. And when I reported what was going on in Indonesia, that Muslims were shooting Christians on site, the guest said, "That's right, it's going on."
We have about 5 minutes here, and I want to make sure we get a comment, a response, particularly since the caller specifically raised Egypt, and you've reported on there. Ms. Abdo, what do you think?
I just want to be brief because I'd like to get back to the subject that we were supposed to be discussing. I think that I'm sorry, but I do think the caller is exaggerating the tension that exists in all these countries between Muslims and Christians. Yes, there is tension, and yes, there are sporadic clashes that occur, and they are reported and they're documented, and we all know about that. But I will speak specifically about Egypt. In Upper Egypt, in the southern part of Egypt, in the 1990s, militants clashed with cops in towns such as Luxor, in areas such as Minya. It is difficult to know who instigated these clashes. And even when I went to report some of these stories, it was difficult to know who initiated the violence. A lot of the violence has occurred because of the Islamic revival in many of the countries the caller mentioned, and Christians feel that they're under some sort of siege. And that's definitely the case. But I think that it's not quite as simplistic as the caller makes it out to be. And it's difficult in many of these countries to know what the source of the violence is. It's not just a simple situation that Muslims have gone on a rampage against Christians. And so that's my answer.
Obviously, this all suggests that our commitment here, however imperfect it may be, to the idea of multiculturalism and having a free and open society is going to clash if we're trying to establish some kind of relationship with people who aren't committed to that. And obviously there are Muslims who think everybody should be Muslim, and there are Christians who think everybody should be Christian, and then there are some people who think that people can be what they want. But it seems as if we're going to have a difficult time here finding some sort of common ground to stand on if we're going to have a conversation with people who are interested in establishing Islamic-based societies.
Well, certainly. I mean, that's the whole challenge of the modern world now, is how East and West are going to find some sort of accommodation. And the most, greatest example of that is September 11th. I mean, this is how are we going to find accommodation with the Muslim world? How are we going to reconcile our value system with theirs? And the two are very different. The same kind of conflict is going on to some extent in the countries that we've mentioned. And when you have minorities who have different religion, who have a different value system, of course this is a conflict that needs to be sorted out. But I don't think that it's fair to paint this as a picture in which Muslims want to destroy, to kill the infidel. I mean, that unfortunately is what Osama bin Laden articulates, but this is not an opinion that is shared by millions of Muslims across the Muslim world, from Indonesia to the Arab world. And I think that, you know, we have to be sure to make that distinction. But certainly it's not, it can't be reduced to just a war between Christians and Muslims, and it shouldn't be portrayed that way. There are a lot of more profound issues here at stake.
Or, as you note in this the piece that I mentioned way at the beginning of the program in the Monitor, between capitalism and something else, or between Western materialism and something else. I mean, you referenced Mr. Barber's famous book, and he's been here on the show to talk about it, The Jihad versus Mech World. In your sort of take, is that that's really not what this, it's not what the conflict is all about, that there's no clear, at least from your experience and what you've seen in Egypt, that line is not clear there.
Yes, definitely not. I mean, I have to say that certainly Mr. Barber represents one view among scholars, and that is that part of the tension now is that the Muslim world is somehow envious of our prosperity, envious of our value system, envious of our lifestyles. And I just couldn't disagree more. And there are many scholars who agree with me and who take the opposite view, which is that this is sort of a Western take on what's going on, that somehow if we give Muslims a paved street and a nice apartment, that they're not going to go to the mosque anymore. And they're not going to hate us, as another cliche that has developed since September 11th. Why do they hate us? This is simply not the case. It's more of a situation where the Muslim world does not really care so much about what our value system is. They don't care about our prosperity as long as we don't try to impose that on them. And that's really the bottom line. And because the United States has been so involved politically in trying to formulate policies in many of the countries at the core of this conflict, this is why the anti-American sentiment has developed. And of course, in the background of all of this is the United States' involvement in the peace process and the fact that the United States has been a great supporter of Israel, and the United States' role is perceived by Palestinians and Muslims as being unfair to the Palestinian cause. I mean, look at what's even happened in the last few days. Yasser Arafat has been declared a terrorist, both by Ariel Sharon and by the U.S. administration. So, and this is a man who was legitimately elected by the Palestinian people. So, this is the kind of sort of animosity that stems from the Arab-Israeli conflict, and this is really what the conflict is about. It's not about economic crisis. It's not about envy over our prosperity. It's about the United States being more sensitive to what the Muslim world wants.
We'll have to stop. We're out of time. We'll have to promise to people that we'll continue to try to get at these issues from different perspectives in the future. But for right now, we'll have to leave it. Genève Abdo, she's currently Nieman Fellow at Harvard, former correspondent for The Guardian and The Economist, author of the book No God But God, Egypt and the Triumph of Islam, published by the Oxford University Press. Ms. Abdo, thanks very much for talking with us.